Shalom, and thank you for studying the Book of Galatians with us at BethEmmanuel.org.
Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's virtual community and support our efforts for the kingdom by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
We are learning the Book of Galatians, the first epistle of the Holy Apostle Paul, written to the community of God-fearing Gentile believers in the region of Galatia, the cities of Pisidian Antioch and Iconium. And in these early passages of the book of Galatians, Paul is providing his readers with some background material, some anecdotes, if you will, from his own spiritual journey and his experience with the message of the gospel as directed toward non-Jews. And in the previous teaching, we were reading in the second chapter in Galatians 2 and verse 2, where Paul described his second trip to Jerusalem after becoming a believer, where he said, I went up because of a revelation and set before them, though privately before those who seemed influential, the gospel that I proclaim among the Gentiles, in order to make sure I was not running or had not run in vain. Paul and Barnabas have gone up to Jerusalem, carrying a donation raised from the Antioch community, a donation for the Avionim, the poor ones, the community of believers in Jerusalem, to fortify them against the coming years of scarcity, against a famine predicted by the prophet Locust. And with them they have brought Titus, Paul's traveling companion from Antioch, a Gentile, a God-fearing Gentile, a God-fearing Gentile believer from Antioch. Now Paul has an ulterior motive, we learned, an ulterior motive for this trip. Paul intends on using the opportunity for a private meeting with the apostles, with the pillars, with the Beit Din over the believers, and with James, Yaakov, Hatzadik, the brother of the master, the steward, if you will, of the throne of David. He wants to present his gospel to them, namely the version of the gospel that he has been proclaiming in Antioch among the Gentiles, which is that God-fearing Gentiles, God-fearing Gentile believers in Yeshua of Nazareth need not become Jewish in order to inherit salvation, to enter the kingdom of heaven, to obtain citizenship in the people of God, that is, Israel. That Gentiles need not be Jewish, but that faith in Yeshua, or we should say, the faith of Yeshua, is sufficient for even Gentiles. And this is the radical message that in the previous teaching we saw Paul taking to the council of the elders in Jerusalem, to James, to Peter, to John, to the elders present that constituted the legal authority, the court of law over all believers, the high court over all believers and followers of Yeshua, and ultimately the high court over all Israel. That what they would bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and what they will loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. So Paul goes to them for an endorsement of his message, and he says, in order to make sure that I was not running or had not run in vain. That is to say, if they said to him, if they ruled saying, Brother Shaul, we commend you for your heart and your zeal, but you have gone astray and you have led the Gentiles astray. Now then, it is needful for them to be circumcised and to become Jewish, and to submit to all the obligations incumbent upon Jewish people, in order for them to be a part of the kingdom of heaven, and in order for them to be a part of us. If they had said that, what if they had said that? If they had said that to Paul, then Paul's message to the Gentiles, the gospel he had been proclaiming, would be invalid. And as a man under authority, Paul would have to go back to Antioch, and back to all those whom he had so misled, and apologize to them, and say to them, I am sorry, I was wrong. You do need to become Jewish. And so that is what we learned in the previous teaching. Paul's private meeting with the pillars, those who were of reputation, those who seemed to be influential, and not only influential, but in positions of authority, to censure him, if necessary. To censor him, if necessary. To correct him, if necessary. For Paul, the interview was a dramatic moment. Something like when you are 14 or 15 in the 9th or 10th grade and you're summoned to the principal's office for a meeting with your parents and the superintendent of the school for the crime of writing, reproducing, and distributing a subversive version of the student newspaper. Because Paul's gospel was controversial like that and had huge implications for the faith of the believers and the constitution of the synagogue and not just believing congregations, but Jewish synagogues everywhere. Because if Gentile believers were not compelled to become proselytes, sons of Abraham, circumcised in the case of men, simply legally converted in the case of women, if they were not so compelled, then the constitution of the community of Israel was jeopardized. Well, Paul manages, we learn in verse 9, to secure this private meeting, a confidential meeting, with James, Yaakov HaTzadik, the brother of the Master, with Shimon Kifa, that is Peter, the head of the 12 apostles, and with Yochanan ben Zavdai, John, the beloved disciple. The top of the top. Maybe like scoring a meeting with the president, the vice president, and the secretary of state. Or maybe like scoring a meeting with the pope and two of his vice popes. It's like meeting with the superintendent of the school, the high school principal, and your dad. And Paul submits his gospel before them. And he presents his case. And he says, this is what I'm teaching. This is what I am presenting to the Gentiles. This is what I'm telling the Gentiles. Now, what do you think? Is it kosher? And with him, he has brought Titus. He's brought Titus to the meeting, which is strange. Why? Why is Titus there? What does Titus have to do with it? Is Titus like a guinea pig? Is he the token Gentile? Is it like Paul brings him in and says to the apostles, look, fellows, I brought a goy. What do you think? Do we call him oil or not? I don't think that was the situation. Instead, we read in verse 4, we read about why Titus was brought along. Verse 4 explains that Titus was part of the discussion, Paul says, because of false brothers secretly brought in who slipped in to spy out our freedom that we have in Christ Jesus, so that they may bring us into slavery. This verse is going to require some unpacking. You know, it's hard to put the pieces back together. Who are these false brothers? In what sense are they false? In what sense have they been brought in? Where did they slip into? What is the freedom in Messiah Yeshua on which they are spying? Who is the we in the verse? Who is it that they sought to subject to slavery? And what does Paul mean by slavery? All of these questions need to be answered, or at least an attempt needs to be made, before we can make sense of this. And unfortunately, we cannot have definite answers to all of these questions. We can make some educated guesses, some inferences, and that's what we're going to spend our time today doing. Let me begin with Mark Nanos and his book, The Irony of Galatians. Mark Nanos is a Jewish scholar, not a believer, but one of the top New Testament scholars in the world, at least as far as Pauline studies goes, an authority on Paul. I don't necessarily agree with every conclusion he has arrived at in his interpretation of Galatians, but I find all of his conclusions compelling and well argued, and I do not hesitate to recommend his work. In any event, what does Nanos say about the identity of these false brothers? First of all, he does not assume that they were believers. We've seen elsewhere that brothers in Pauline literature can refer to the Jewish people in general. Not that they are false Jews, but rather Nanos suggests that they are non-Yeshua-believing Jews. And that Paul calls them false brothers not to suggest that their brotherhood as Jews is false, but rather their motives were false. Jewish people with false motives. This is Nanos' opinion. I disagree with it. I think in this context, Paul uses brothers to refer to fellow believers, and false brothers is Paul's way of dismissing their sincerity as believers. It's vitriolic. It's Paul's vitriolic assessment of their sincerity as believers. But I bring up Nanos because he raises an interesting suggestion then. He goes on to retranslate the word, the Greek word that's translated as spying, to spy out, where it says, who slipped in to spy out our freedom. He retranslates this with the English word to investigate. And then he suggests that it's not that they were spies, so to speak, but rather investigators, perhaps official investigators, officially investigating on behalf of another body, what they considered to be a problem for Judaism. Nanos suggests that they were investigating on behalf of some administrative authority. One presumes the Sanhedrin. Now, that may or may not be the case, but it's sufficient to say that they had concerns about Paul, about his message, and about his work among the Gentiles, and they were investigating. Where did they slip into? We don't know. Nanos suggests they may have slipped into the meeting with the apostles, which may be. I would suggest that they slipped into the fellowship of the Antioch community, because we have already seen that there was regular traffic between the Jerusalem community of believers and the Antioch community of believers. And when the Gentiles first began joining the faith in Antioch, remember from the book of Acts, the apostles in Jerusalem sent Barnabas to investigate. In fact, Paul and Barnabas are in Jerusalem because of a prophecy offered by Locust, who had come to Antioch in the company of several other Jewish believers from Jerusalem. So there is regular traffic between the apostolic community in Jerusalem and the community of believers in Antioch. So I would suggest to you that these so-called false brothers are actually believers from the Jerusalem community, Jewish believers, who had traveled to Antioch, who had become familiar with the situation there, become familiar with the work there, and gotten to know the people and the message that Paul was preaching. And unbeknownst to Paul, to Barnabas, and to the other Antioch believers, these so-called false brothers, Jewish believers from Jerusalem, were all the while investigating the Gentile phenomenon in Antioch, or as Paul puts it, freedom that we have in the Messiah, Yeshua. What is this freedom? I don't know the whole scope of it, but I do know this, that it starts with circumcision. It starts with the concept that Gentiles, like Titus, were free from the mitzvah of circumcision. They were free from becoming proselytes, gerim. So let's start there and test that. In the Torah, we learn that it is a mitzvah for a man to be circumcised, and to circumcise his son on the eighth day, or subsequently. Let's turn to Genesis 17 and just review that. Indulge me. This may seem unnecessary, but I don't want to make any assumptions. Genesis 17, verse 9, where we learn that it is a commandment of the Torah, a mitzvah, to be circumcised and to circumcise. It says, "And God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you throughout your generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised." I might have thought that this rule applied only to a baby 8 days old. But an uncircumcised adult would not be required to undergo circumcision so long as he circumcised his sons. But instead, it says, every male among you. I might have thought that the law applied only to the physical descendants of Abraham, only to his literal, biological children. But the law says, every male among you. Verse 11, "You shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you." Oat, a sign, oat. Circumcision is one of several commandments in the Torah that is regarded as an oat, a sign. In the diaspora synagogues and among the sages and legal authorities of Israel, the Jewish community did not consider these sign commandments as incumbent upon non-Jews, because non-Jews were not part of the covenant, so it seems fairly obvious. So they weren't pressuring the average Gentile to become circumcised. The Jewish people living in the diaspora didn't look at uncircumcised Gentiles as if they were living in sin because they were uncircumcised, because they weren't part of the covenant, so they had no obligation to keep the covenant sign. But Gentile believers, with Gentile believers, that's another matter. Gentile believers were now claiming position in the people of God, claiming to be part of God's covenant with Israel, and therefore, logically, they should be keeping the sign commandments, because if they're part of the covenant, they should keep the sign of the covenant, and that's how the logic goes, and it is logical. It is logical. It makes good sense. It makes good, consistent sense. But that's not what Paul taught. That's not what he was teaching. He taught that they need not keep the sign of circumcision. Here, we're still reading in Genesis 17, verse 12. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male throughout your generations, whether born in your house or bought with your money from any foreigner who is not of your offspring. So here it says, whether born in your house, which would be Abraham's own literal sons, Ishmael and Isaac, and the sons of his servants and maidservants, in fact, would also fall into the category of born in his house. And it also says any servant bought with money from any ger, from any foreigner, a ger that is brought into Abraham's household. This is a clear and certain rule of the Torah. It goes on, verse 13. Both he who is born in your house and he who is bought with your money shall surely be circumcised. So shall my covenant be in your flesh, an everlasting covenant. Any uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. Okay, that's the passage. The rule for a member of Abraham's family who is not circumcised, any uncircumcised male, is that he is to be cut off from his people. What does it mean to be cut off? There's two meanings. The rabbis speak of being cut off by the hands of men and cut off by the hands of heaven. Cut off by the hands of men could mean excision from the community, or it might even mean capital punishment, depending upon the crime and situation and verdict of the court. Cut off by heaven means premature death, a death sentence from God. And we see an example of the latter in the case of Moses, who had not circumcised his son Gershom. So the angel of the Lord appeared to him and Zipporah, and the angel of the Lord was going to put Moses to death, and would have put Moses to death, if not for the quick intervention of his wife Zipporah, who circumcised the young man. Gershom was no longer 8 days old. The mitzvah to circumcise the young man still stood, and was so grievous, the fact that he had not circumcised this child was so grievous before God, that even after the appearance of the Lord in the burning bush, while still on his way to Egypt to challenge Pharaoh, the Lord appeared to Moses and was going to put him to death, cut him off, for he has broken my covenant. So it's a serious, serious matter in the Torah. And these so-called false brothers investigating in Antioch, I believe they were disturbed to see the, quote, freedom in the Messiah Yeshua, unquote, that Paul was proclaiming, when they understood that it meant freedom from circumcision for those who claimed to be a part of the covenant with Abraham, the covenant with Israel. When Paul and Barnabas and Titus arrived in Jerusalem, these brothers, who had been in Antioch, were there. I'm totally speculating now, but I think we can ascertain that they were there, and that they recognized Titus. And it's they who approach the elders, the apostles, the dean of the believers, and place this matter before the believers. They came to them, and they said to the apostles, they said, Shaul of Tarsus and Barnabas have brought with them one fellow named Titus, a God-fearer, and a Gentile from Antioch. And though they include him in the fellowship, in the prayers, in the community, And in all of our functions, the fellow is neither circumcised, nor does he intend on becoming circumcised. So now let's see if we can answer these questions. Who are these false brothers? Believing Jews, I think, from Jerusalem. In what sense are they false? Only in the sense that Paul does not regard their allegiance to Messiah as sincere. In what sense have they been brought in? They brought their complaint and their concern against Titus to the authorities in Jerusalem, to James, to Peter, to John, and to the elders. Where did they slip into? I believe they slipped into the fellowship of the community of believers in Antioch. What is the freedom in Messiah Yeshua which they were investigating? The freedom on which they were spying is that the Gentile believers were not keeping the covenant sign commandments, or at the very least, not keeping the sign of circumcision. Who is the we? Paul refers to himself and to Barnabas and the message they were preaching and teaching among the Gentiles. So the we in the passage is the God-fearing believers in Antioch and their teachers. Who is it that they sought to subject to slavery? And what does Paul mean by slavery? They sought to require the Gentile believers to keep the sign commandments, at a minimum, the sign of circumcision, which entailed not just circumcision literally, but full legal conversion to Judaism. Yet that does not diminish the fact that it did require circumcision literally. So they have brought this matter to the attention of the elders, the men that Paul was seeking a private audience with, the principal, the superintendent, the father. And so Paul brings Titus with him to the meeting, presents his case for why he thinks Titus can remain Titus, the Gentile, and does not need to keep the sign of the covenant with Abraham. And it seems that perhaps these false brothers may indeed have been present at the meeting, we don't know. But Paul says, to them we did not yield in submission, even for a moment, so that the truth of the gospel might be preserved for you. For who? Not just for the Galatians to whom he's writing, but for Gentile believers everywhere. So what is the outcome, the decision, when he says, we did not yield in submission even for a moment? Nanos suggests that the we includes James, Peter, and John, and the rest of the apostles in that meeting, that together they did not yield to the pressure regarding Titus, because Paul announces the verdict in verse 3. In Galatians 2, verse 3, Paul says, but even Titus, who was with me, was not forced to be circumcised, though he was a Greek. Which is to say, Paul learned that he had not run his race in vain, but instead he received the apostolic endorsement that he had been seeking. They considered his case, his presentation, his argument, his gospel, and they endorsed it. The letter of Galatians is an explanation of Paul's argument.
And learn from me, and find rest for your soul.